Hello and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm your host for today, Jamie Katz, and a big thanks to Tracy Morgan, the original, the primal host of this show. And today, for your pleasure and for my pleasure, I'm talking with John Fletcher, whose book, Freud and the Scene of Trauma, from Fordham University Press, was recently published. John Fletcher is an associate professor of English and comparative studies at University of Warwick in England, where he's been teaching for many years. He's published a lot of articles about psychoanalysis in many different journals, psychoanalytic and otherwise. He often focuses on the work of the French psychoanalyst Jean Laplanche, whose work he's also extensively translated and edited. Many of his lectures from his undergraduate course, Literature and Psychoanalysis, Trauma, Fantasy, The Death Drive, were recorded and are available on the internet as podcast audio recordings. You can easily find them by searching for Psychoanalysis Podcast, where they appear as the top hit, even above this program, which is, I think, saying something. And that's where I initially found his work. I listened to all 25 hours that are on the internet, and I was so impressed that I've since read several of his papers and was also drawn to read or reread many of the sources he discusses, including Freud and Laplanche's work. And of course, I was drawn to his new book, which I experienced in large part as a sort of advanced continuation of those fantastic podcast lectures. And we're talking with John Fletcher. John Fletcher, welcome.
Hello.
So can you give us an overview of your work in general and of your new book?
Well, the book, it's the context of the book, I suppose, is 20 years of work on and off on psychoanalysis in general, but in particular with the work of the French psychoanalyst who recently died, Jean Laplanche, who's mainly known in the Anglophone world as the co-editor, co-writer, co-author of Laplanche and Pontalis, the great theoretical dictionary of psychoanalysis in English called The Language of Psychoanalysis. So I was fascinated by his work very early on, particularly the essay that he co-authored with Pontalis on fantasy, which was first translated and printed in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis and then in various anthologies since then, and started reading his work whenever I could lay hands on it. And then there wasn't a lot in English. There was Jeffrey Egan's very distinguished translation of Life and Death in Psychoanalysis back in the 1970s. And it wasn't a lot else of Laplanche's in English, a couple of pieces in the IJP. So I started reading him in French and became interested in translating him and getting his work into circulation. And he came over to Britain on a number of occasions, and there were seminars at the Freud Museum, at the University of Kent, at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London. And so I was able to put them together in a first volume of his work, which came out in 92, a sort of dossier of recorded, transcribed seminars and essays by people about him and translations of him. And that was the takeoff point, really. I suppose it's been living with Laplanche's work, because he's a great translator himself, a translator of Freud, in a way, more so even than Lacan, he implemented the return to Freud and to the Freudian text in a series of lectures at the Sorbonne, which were all published. Well, they're sort of seminar, we call seminars, but they're really lectures, a seven-volume series called Problematique, where he systematically works through Freud's work, and this is, you know, side by side with his translation. In French, there wasn't the equivalent of Strachey's magnificent 24-volume standard edition. There were rival and competing translations of individual texts, most of them pretty deficient and full of errors. There was never a French oeuvre complète until in the late 60s. I think it was about 68, maybe 66, that Laplanche and a group around him started off producing an oeuvre complète in French, translating from the beginning, working through the German. And that, in a way, was a source of a lot of his insights. and a particular way of understanding the emergence of the Freudian field as a distinct conceptual field. It comes out of a French tradition of history and philosophy of science. People like Canguilhem and Bachelard, who have a particular way of understanding the formation of conceptual fields, which is different from, say, the way in Anglophone history and philosophy of science, paradigm theory, or just ordinary empiricism as accumulation of discoveries, individual discoveries. There's a very distinct way of understanding the formation and reformation of conceptual fields, and that's been a background influence on the way in which he and Canteleu drew up their dictionary and the way in which they think about Freud's work.
I learned a lot from that. Can you give us some examples of sort of like a Laplanchian reading of Freud?
Well, a lot of it is centered around the way in which certain terms and concepts get lost and but turn up again in other forms. Three major Freudian concepts, which have either disappeared or been, as it were, survived in a simplified, travestied form. One would be the notion of the drive. And in Freud's German, the distinction between Trieb and instinct, where instinct is spelled in German with a K. And that's just got lost in Strachey's standard edition. Strachey at least tells you that's what he's doing. He's saying, I'm going to translate it by the English word instinct. So whenever the word instinct turns up in the standard edition, the German word is Trieb. And when the German word instinct turns up, which isn't very often, but it does turn up occasionally, he has a little footnote telling you that. But the effect is to collapse the conceptual difference between the two terms in Freud's German. And it has the unfortunate effect of massively rebiologizing the drive as if it were a biological instinct, and so rather than a distinct psychical formation. And that's one of the crucial things that Laplanche picks up and develops and runs with, the consequences of that radical distinction between drive and instinct, which is ambiguous. It's not by any means secure, and Freud never wrote, unfortunately, a metapsychological paper in which he spelled out the differences between the two. So you have to sort of work out, you know, the different conceptual profiles of the two terms in Freud's German from the way he uses them, really. But that's been pretty crucial. Another closely related concept, which was just absent in Anglophone literature, is Lenon, the notion of leaning on. Strachey does translate the term in a sort of technical Greek-derived term, but it gets lost. The specificity of it gets very much lost. And it's a way of specifying the connection between the emergence of the psychical drive and the instinctual self-preservative function on which it leans in the German, on Lenon. In French, that was translated, I think, unfortunately translated, ironically, as by A.T.A.R., leaning on. And Jeffrey Mailman translated it as propping in his translation of Laplanche. So there's a whole debate there around how to specify the emergence of the drive in relationship to the instinctual function on which it leans or models itself and then from which it deviates.
And in English, that was the Strachey translation was anaclitic and
other. That's right. It's a term from grammar, really. A Greek specialist term that only grammarians use in English to refer to the way in which certain parts of speech or certain words only appear when propped up or leaning on another word, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. There's a quite important relation there, as it has consequences, but which just the importance of which is just lost, really. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's translating Freud's German into French forced Laplanche and his interesting to think about the specificity of this conceptual family, because there's not just that one word, but there's a kind of family of words that are formed out of the notion of anlehnung or leaning on. Mm. So, and that's closely related to the drive instinct distinction. Mm. And the other big or crucial sort of lost concept, if you like, is the notion of Nachträglichkeit in Freud's German, again, it's something that Strachey translates by a whole range of different English words. So the specificity as a conceptual family at work in Freud's thought and in his writing gets lost. The one set phrase that I suppose that Strachey uses is that of deferred action. Mm-hmm. It's not just the abstract term, Nachträglichkeit, but the Nachträglich is an adjective or as an adverb, and some other combinations that appears in Freud's writing. And it all gets translated into English as later, subsequently, afterwards. And you wouldn't know as an English reader that there's a conceptual family there, or conceptual matrix, mm. out of which Freud is generating new terms. Mm. And again, deferred action is a problematic translation because it's a one-way linear movement in time from the past to the future. Mm-hmm. As Lepanche and others have brought out, but Lepanche is in a way the main developer of that reflector, if you like, on that, as it were, lost Freudian concept, points out it's a double temporal dimension. In the way Freud uses it, and Freud's usage of it is variable, and maybe even at times some of the variations are contradictory. But there is a double dimension in which something may be that is inscribed in one moment is reactivated in another moment. But that's not just a question of postponement or delay. In that the second moment acts back on the first. So there is a regressive movement in time, as it were. And it's the interplay between those temporal dimensions that are crucial in trying to grasp the at times slippery complexity of the concept in Freud and in Freud's thought.
Yeah, this was an important part of your book, Freud and the Scene of Trauma, that the way this relates to trauma.
Yes, that in a way that's at the heart of my book. Is an attempt to trace, if you like, the adventures or the misadventures of that concept in Freud's work. And Lepanche had argued that the concept returns in different ways and at different moments. It originally is formulated in the context of the so-called seduction theory of the mid-1890s. And there it's got a very specific set of connections and, of course, a set of limitations, because the seduction theory is tied to forms of psychopathology, hysteria in the first instance, then obsessional neurosis, the tracing of a cause back to quite violent, often and abusive forms of sexual experience imposed on the infant or the young child. And the outcome was always seen as being some destructive form of psychopathology. So it's trapped within that formation, as it were, within that framework. And when Freud struggles against that, because he starts to make a move from what I've called from symptom to subjectivity, so that when he abandons formally the seduction theory, he's not just changing, looking for another explanation for the same object, because he's changing the object. The object to be explained changes, not just the explanation. And he's trying to give an account of the formation of human psychical structures and of sexuality per se, not just of psychopathology. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing, there's a shift, a sort of multiple paradigm shift or shift of a problematic, if you again to use the French term.
I mean, is Freud only sort of widening the field to be explored, or is I know in your book you sort of argue that as he does that, something is lost from the original theory.
Yes. Well, what's recognized at a descriptive level in the original theory is the role of the other, the role of the adult other, and of an adult other who has a developed sexuality in an unconscious, which then impacts on the infant or on the child. And it's that fundamental relation to the other that Freud encounters in a grotesque and violent form in the seduction theory and in the patients he was struggling to work with and to understand. But it's never properly theorized as such. There are very telling formulations that he uses, particularly in the letters to Fleece. But he talks about the other of a sort of primal other who's there from the beginning and who is never matched by anyone later. but the emphasis on the other gets lost and returns again. Is there at a descriptive level? But it never gets properly integrated and conceptualized as the other is prior to the formation of the subject. So the other exists in seduction theory and in a lot of psychoanalysis, because all psychoanalysts, of course, are aware of the importance of the parents. but the parents often figure as the objects of fantasy, figures onto whom the child's fantasy is projected, and not prior or absolutely fundamental, primal cat figures who provoke and kickstart the formation of psychical, of the psychical structure.
Right. So the parents are always sort of on the outside, but there's a strain of Freudian theory that's like everything starts on the inside of the person.
That's right. Yes, that's exactly right, and that's where Laplanche, in trying to think about the strange things that happen in the Freudian field and in its various evolutions, etc., brings in the analogy with cosmology and with the Copernican revolution. He initially takes that from Freud's own self-designation, where Freud sees psychoanalysis as the third in a series of revolutions, of a Copernican revolution at the level of the mind, as it were, and their movements or revolutions of decentering, so that there's a whole history of a struggle between geocentric, which became the dominant form of cosmological thought, summarized in the great summary work of Ptolemy, where everything's centered on the Earth, and the various stars and planets move around different complex orbits, etc., around the Earth, and an alternative, but marginalized and at times even persecuted tradition of thought, which sees the sun as the center. And even up into the Renaissance with Galileo and Copernicus, of course, they're under threat from the church. The Christian church sees this as a calling into question of their whole divine cosmology, as it were. So a revolutionary movement of decentering, which reacts against a hitherto dominant model that is a sort of centering on the human and on the place of the human in the earth. And Freud sees Darwin accomplishing such a conceptual revolution with evolution, which sees the human species not as, in the book of Genesis, put in place to rule over and to order the natural world, or to care for it in various versions of this founding myth of origins, but as simply one species that have evolved at a certain point under certain conditions as a sort of decentering. Freud then offers himself in psychoanalysis as the third stage, in which the ego is not master in its own house. It comes up against symptoms and things it doesn't understand that feel as if they have come from the outside, and which it struggles against. But in a long speech to the ego in that essay of Freud, 1917, I think it is, where he elaborates this at its fullest. This story of the 3D centerings. The ego has to learn that the things that it feels as being alien are things that it is disowned and repressed and repudiated, but which are essentially part of itself. And Laplanche picks up this cosmological analogy and turns it against Freud. So his version of it, of the distinction between the Copernican and the Ptolemaic, doesn't coincide with Freud's, because he wants to say that actually in that very essay, the gesture that turns around and says, these alien things that appear to have possessed you from without are really you, and you have to learn to accept them as your feelings, your impulses, your memories, whatever they might be. And Laplanche sees that as a sort of inevitable return to centering that takes place, whereas otherness gets reduced back into the self again. What appears to be other is really just you, and you have to accept that and acknowledge it. This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine, the famous line of Prospero's about Caliban in the Tempest sums up that injunction, if you like.
Why is that movement of Freud's where he recenters or sort of takes back something, like you said, he doesn't quite explicitly theorize it, but it's in his work, and then he sort of recoils from it. Why is that inevitable? Is that a universal thing that happens to thinkers?
In the case of psychoanalysis, it's got something quite specific to psychoanalytic thought, in the sense that psychoanalytic thought seeks to grapple with, to track the development of, to conceptualize, to understand the formation of the human subject and of human subjectivity. It's a kind of, if you like, almost Hegelian proposition that characterizes Laplanche's take on this, that the movement of the object is replicated in the movement of the thought that seeks to understand the object, and the object in question is the human object. And Laplanche says at one point, it doesn't make sense to say of the physical universe that it was originally Ptolemaic and then was originally Copernican and then became Ptolemaic, if you like. But it does make sense to make that argument about the formation of the human subject. The human subject begins centered on the other, not on itself, in its radical dependency, its radical openness. So this is very opposed to certain forms of ego psychology that see, a kind of closure of the subject, you know, from the very beginning, and the problem is, how does the subject open up to the outside world and find the first not me object, as Winnicott says, and the traditional object, which is the bridge between the solipsistic enclosed little humanoid ego, who then has to open out into a world of others and of other objects. And Laplanche is actually the reverse of that. The human infant is radically vulnerable, radically open, and has to acquire defenseless boundaries, the possibility of closure to protect itself from what comes to it, as it were, because it is, as in the little story of the vesicle that Freud tells, the sort of theoretical myth or allegory of the vesicle that Freud tells in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, the infant begins life, you know, radically open and radically dependent, unable to do things for itself in a way that's extreme by analogy with, say, even relatively close animal species. The need for the infant is to acquire a boundary, to acquire defenses, to acquire an ego, if you like. The ego isn't there. And Freud says that in your narcissism paper. You know, the ego isn't there from the beginning. It has to be formed. And what are the processes? What is the new psychical action that turns the autoerotic primal drives into a narcissistically loved ego? But he's quite capable of saying the opposite of that, and positing a kind of some sort of ego that's there from the beginning. And that again is one of those instances where, like, that the Trieb instinct ambiguity, the ego that is formed at a later stage by a new psychical action as against a kind of ego that's there from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And the same with the concept of the unconscious. Laplanche argues there's the unconscious as a formation, as a construction produced by primal repression, which is the unconscious as theorized in the metapsychological papers of 1915. And then there's the primal id, the id that is there from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Mailman, I think, in a wonderfully eloquent comment in his introduction to his translation of Life and Death, says the Freudian conceptual apparatus is, as it were, cassetted by two alternative conceptualities, as it were. There are alternating and conflicting meanings attached to some of the key terms in Freud's thought. So there's the primal id that there's from the beginning, and then there's the unconscious that is constructed in and through repression as the other side of the formation of the ego and its defenses and its boundaries. And there's an oscillation between the two in Freud. Mm-hmm. Now that oscillation is understood by Laplanche not as just, why can't Freud be self-consistent, give him 5 out of 10 or even less for logical consistency, but that is driven by the way in which his thought is magnetized by and compelled by what Laplanche calls an exigence, an exigency, something that's in the nature of the object itself that both impels the thought that seeks to grapple with it, but also leads it off into recenterings, impasses, what he calls the French word fourvoiement, which going astray. Mm-hmm. So the going astray isn't just as simple to be understood as making an error or making a mistake, because the very going astray at the level of theory replicates what is happening in the formation of the structure of the human being.
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting way of reading Freud, because it's you and Laplanche, you read him very closely, and it's like full of sort of a sense of respect and trying to find threads that are, you know, very difficult to, you know, they're not explicitly said by Freud. But at the same time, there's a sort of a critique that doesn't, the tone isn't condemning of Freud or attacking him.
No. Well, there's been so much of that, hasn't there? So much Freud bashing and Freud trashing, and even psychoanalysts seem to have been affected by that. You know, I was just rather shocked by recent books on Freud's, from which I learned something, but which then at a certain moment, you know, have an attitude of kind of embarrassment and dismissal of key moments in Freud's thought, etc. So it's the critique, you need some sort of immanent critique that understands the way in which the Freudian field is impelled by a contradictory gravitational tugs, if you like, which can be summed up metaphorically as, you know, the Copernican and the Ptolemaic, the decentering movements of thought and their recentering. And the recentering takes place in the human psyche, as it were, because in order to survive psychically, the human subject forms defenses, boundaries, withdraws from, you know, the input that has come from the other in order to defend itself against another that is understood by Laplanche as seductive. And so he wants to formulate what he calls a general theory of seduction, a seduction that is a primal seduction, but also something that's excessive and exciting and traumatizing in an almost technical sense of the word, something that is that implants or inscribes highly charged excessive, something that are excessive and can't be made sense of by the recipient. This human subject in formation struggles to translate and to bind and to filter and to defend itself against these exciting, seductive, traumatizing transmissions that come from the adult other, on which it is in its earlier stages so radically dependent.
Uh-huh. And your examples of that are sexual trauma and things like that, but there's also the example of little Hans's mother commenting on his genitals and that being sort of an enigmatic moment for him.
And exciting. Mm-hmm. And of course, you take Little Hands as a case study, and when I teach it, I always teach it alongside the second essay on infantile sexuality from the three essays. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, the case study exemplifies and concretizes and appears to confirm Freud's theory of infantile sexuality, and he's enormously pleased by that, and grateful to Little Hands, you know, for being, you know, such a perfect exemplification. On the other hand,
the oral phase, the anal phase.
Yes, that, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you compare the text carefully, the term fantasy hardly appears in the three essays at all, and certainly not in their first version. And it appears marginally or minimally in later, you know, editions, which are so many of them to the three essays. Fantasy just isn't there. And yet the case study turns entirely around fantasy. You know, the fantasy of the horse that might come into the room at night and bite him, the horse that might hurt Gemunden, the horse that falls down and makes a noise with its feet, the horse that has a black muzzle. Little Hans is this extraordinarily prolific producer of fantasies through which, you know, he negotiates his way, you know, in relationship to the demands that are made on him by the parents, some of them explicit, some of them at the level of unconscious wishes and unconscious desire. So he finds himself in this highly charged familial field, and he produces this endless series of fantasies as a way of shift, you know, negotiating and repositioning himself. And that's what's so wonderful about the case study. It's so rich in terms of Little Hands' struggle at a kind of self-symbolization and a self-positioning. And none of that's there in the three essays, you know, particularly in infantile sexuality essay. It's quite extraordinary how the absences, if you like, in that early text of Freud's. And yet, a wonderful moment in the third essay where Freud is talking about the finding of an object, adult object choice, is in fact a refinding of it. And this is wonderfully poignant and really quite moving couple of brief but eloquent description of maternal seduction. Of what Le Plante would call, I guess, primal seduction, where he says, I can actually read a couple of sentences from it. He says, a child's intercourse with anyone responsible for his care affords him an unending source of sexual excitations and satisfaction from his erotogenic zones. This is especially so since the person in charge of him, who, after all, is as a rule his mother, herself regards him with feelings that are derived from her own sexual life. She strokes him, she kisses him, rocks him, and quite clearly treats him as a substitute for a complete sexual object. A mother would probably be horrified if she were made aware that all her marks of affection were rousing her child's sexual instinct and preparing for its later intensity. She regards what she does as asexual, pure love, since, after all, she carefully avoids applying more excitations to the child's genitals that are unavoidable in nursery care. And then he, a bit later, this is wonderful sentence, she is, after all, only fulfilling her task in teaching the child to love. So it's a wonderful evocation and description of maternal, almost a celebration of maternal seduction as what awakens and provokes the emergence of the child's drives and which teaches him to love. But it's something that, you know, that comes from the unconscious dimension of the adult's input into the process of nurturing. So seduction there, the awakening of drives or desire in the other, seduction in its proper sense, not just as a euphemism for sexual abuse, it's celebrated, and it's crucial for the development of psychic life. Now, but that all takes place descriptively, you know, at the conceptual level. There is no other, you know, except as an object of the drives rather than as what provokes the drives.
And in your book, I remember you also found passages in Freud where he talks about the father having these rivalrous feelings with the child prior to that aspect of, you know, the Oedipal complex.
Yes, well, that's descriptively there in Little Hans, though he's still, you know, at the end of the case study, as at the dominant level of theorization in three essays, the Oedipus complex is something that spontaneously emerges in the infant, right, rather than something that emerges out of the familial situation, except in Leonardo, you know, where in Freud's wonderful capacity to turn things around 180 degrees, he resituates the whole thing momentarily. And the importance of that, well, the importance of that for my book is that I structured my book around opening chapters, which give a very, very detailed, close, patient, as I hoped, attention to the seduction theory, the emergence of the concept of traumatic seduction and of the repetitions it produces in the text of the 1890s. It's an official abandonment, but the fact that it then continues underground and returns in serial forms, in screen memories, the whole question of screen memories, in the Wolfman case, in transference papers, but also in a wonderful way in the Leonardo text, because their seduction explicitly returns. And Laplanche is the one who sort of started thinking, me and others thinking about the Leonardo case in relationship to the seduction theory. So Laplanche thinks or has argued that the seduction theory doesn't return, but the acknowledgement and the descriptive attention to maternal seduction is central to the whole Leonardo study. But again, to Laplanche at this point, I argue that actually there is a conceptual return too in the form of the screen memory. What I think Laplanche doesn't pay sufficient attention to is that there are two forms of the screen memory, the progressive and the regressive screen memory. And Freud predominantly talks about screen memories in terms of the regressive screen memory. So he says the progressive screen memories are the most common. He then spends all his time analyzing examples, whether it's in the 1899 paper on screen memories or in the chapters in Psychoanalysis of Everyday Life.
A regressive screen memory being something happening now that we project into the past.
Yes, in which an innocent childhood scene comes to represent and to disguise feelings and impulses that are of the present moment or of a much later moment, but which are, as it were, inscribed and congealed and disguised all at once like the 1899 paper of the two little boys playing with their little girl cousin. She has a very lovely little bunch of flowers she's picked, and the two boys turn on her and they, as it were, deflower her. In tears, she runs up to a nurse and she's given some delicious black bread and some butter, and the two boys then throw the flowers away and run up and they demand to be given this as well. And Freud's whole analysis of that, a brilliant, wonderful analysis in its way, is of the way in which adolescent fantasies of Freud's about a young woman whom he had known in his childhood are being recorded and disguised at the same time in this screen memory. But he starts off in the Leonardo case with invoking that same backward regressive logic by looking at the Leonardo's memory of being in his cradle and a huge bird comes down, inserts his tail into his mouth and beats about quite aggressively inside the child's mouth and flies and then leaves him. Leonardo's noting in the margin of this text, which he's written on the flight of kites of Nibio's, says, and this is why I felt that I've always been fated to study the flight of such birds. It's a kind of personal myth of origins of Leonardo. And Freud says the obvious move, well, obviously this is not a real memory. this is a back projection onto infancy. But without quite almost as if he doesn't quite realize it himself, certainly without telling the reader that's what he's doing, that regressive model is inverted into a progressive model, because the final level of inscription that he uncovers behind what initially he sees as a homosexual fantasy is not, as you might have expected, a scene of sexual abuse or something like that, of the kind he's letters to Fleece are full of. But no, it's the child being suckled at the breast. Mm-hmm. So it's a universal experience that everybody has of being nurtured, of oral satisfaction, of the first fundamental oral pleasures, which are then successively represented by this fantasy. And of course, that begs the question, why does it need to be disguised? And particularly, why is it disguised by such a traumatic action, a traumatic scene in which this bird aggressively inserts its tail? And the Italian is per quartesse. It's quite a, you know, percussive. It's quite a violent verb in the Italian. So I work through that to try and demonstrate the way in which the seduction theory as a conceptual formation, not just as a description of seduction, but as a conceptual formation, turns up again in that text under the guise of the concept of the progressive screen memory. So that's it's one of the returns in a really wonderful way. And of course, at the very heart of that, Freud then inverts the whole Oedipal formation. You know, once seduction at the level of description and conceptual formation is allowed to return in his thought and in his writing, we get that extraordinary description of the way in which what is ostensibly starts out as being describing the unique and peculiar situation of Leonardo. He very rapidly generalizes into a series of extraordinary statements about every young husband feels, you know, their favorite to be a rival. The mother-infant relationship, particularly if it's a male infant, satisfies the deepest, most archaic, perverse impulses and gratifications, etc. So you've suddenly got the Oedipus complex as being, you know, maternal seduction and paternal rivalry and aggression. It's completely stood on its head in a way that makes, you know, they're almost... calls out for something like a Lacanian framework of what are the enigmatic, traumatizing transmissions that are coming from the nurturing, protecting adults to the infant. You know, what form of adult psychodrama is being played out in and through the relation to the child? And there it is, suddenly, you know, really, it's extraordinary. Freud just suddenly inverts his whole Oedipal model, you know, and then passes on.
He doesn't comment on it or even notice it.
Yes, it's really quite. But what follows it is even more extraordinary. Of course, it's his celebratory description of the paintings of St. John the Baptist and of Bacchus as these beautiful feminine young men who have this Leonardesque smile, the smile of the mother, in which a secret of love is hidden. And this is kind of almost like a love poem that Freud writes to these beautiful young men, a celebration of male femininity or even male effeminacy in these paintings of Leonardo's. And it's extraordinary. It even comes through Strachey's, at times rather stiff translation, this kind of lyrical celebration of male effeminacy. Not what you'd think you would be getting from Sigmund Freud, but it is a wonderful moment in the text, and it follows on immediately from the inversion of the Oedipus complex. And it's clearly a sign from the beginning, if one was giving a more extensive reading of the Leonardo text, Freud has been seduced. Freud is in love with Leonardo. Mm. It's a whole case study. It's like a love letter to Leonardo. Sigmund loves Leonardo, who is also, of course, a Copernican hero, as Freud points out. You know, there are these diary entries of Leonardo's in which he says, the sun doesn't, il sole non muove, the sun doesn't move, right? We move around it, right? But of course he keeps it to himself, hidden in an unpublished diary. But for Freud, this is another reason why Leonardo. Leonardo is Freud breaks for Leonardo. Leonardo is tops. So a number of these things come together in his texts. And they've obviously got, you know, undeclared but very intimate underground connections with each other. The return of seduction, the inversion of the Oedipus, the celebration of male effeminacy, and the Copernican Revolution. There they all are, all lined up in the one text. It's
quite an
extraordinary text.
Is that your favorite Freud book?
I think in some ways it is. I love teaching it. And I always give the students the Leonardo paintings to look at and to think about.
And those are in the book as well. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I'm completely fascinated by it. I'm seduced as well.
The cycle continues.
Yes.
You also have an amazing section of the book, talking about the transference. And I was just sort of wondering about your and LaPlanche's theories that we've been talking about are more just way of reading being applied clinically. It seems possible to listen in the same way, to listen to patients in the same way that you're reading these texts.
Yes, I think that's true. Certainly, LaPlanche has a very distinct, I elaborate this much more in an article I wrote about on LaPlanche's work in Psychoanalytic Quarterly in 2007. I have an extensive account of LaPlanche's model of the analytic situation. He never publishes any of his own case studies, and people often complain. But he does have an extraordinarily rich and highly developed account of the analytic situation, what its drivers are, and a typology of different forms of transference. It's a very rich, and in its way quite austere, because he really is saying hands off the patients. Mm. He really wants to warn off the analyst from giving a too heavily Freudian or Lacanian or Kleinian or LaPlanchian, construction, as it were. He sees the role of the analyst as being an enabler, he says, as a guardian, a protector of the primary process, because that's what has to happen in the analytic space. Is that that what the analysand brings has to be listened to very carefully for its fault lines and its points of fracture, if you like, and in a sense broken down or deconstructed to enable something else to emerge. But what that something else is, only the patient can tell you. So he's got, in some ways, quite austere practice as a listener.
Have you ever thought of being a clinician or a psychoanalyst? Or?
I had thought about training, but it was very difficult to combine it with the complicated personal and academic life that I was having. I did start off going to some training seminars at one training, and then I just couldn't manage it. But I was in analysis for about 12 years, so I have had an extensive experience from one side of the couch. That is very much alive in one's even sometimes most abstract or theoretical reflections.
Definitely.
They're energized by, those experiences. And I think people who have been in analysis, even though they're non-clinicians, write differently about analysis from people who are just, for whom it's just another theory.
Uh-huh. Were you in analysis with LaPlanche, if I could ask?
No. I was in an analysis in England. That was a British analyst.
Okay. I know you said LaPlanche never wrote about his patients. Maybe his patients would never tell about him also.
I'm not aware of anyone writing about being in analysis with LaPlanche. There's quite a bit about people who've been in analysis with Lacan or with Masoud Khan.
Uh-huh. Freud.
Yeah, or Freud, indeed, or very much so. HD and it's the least of it.
Uh-huh.
The transference papers, replay a lot of the same conceptual anomalies as abstraction theory papers. Mm-hmm. You know, there is some kind of primal scene, and it's repeated in different forms, and or as in a screen memory model. And there's a particular form of temporality of Nachträglichkeit, of what Laplanche suggests that his translation of the German is of afterwardsness, because of course the German word, Freud's German word, comes from quite ordinary words in German, nach und träger, nach meaning after, and the verb träger, to carry or to bear. And of course that Nachträglich can refer to somebody who's bearing or carrying a grudge or a grievance. And they're perfectly ordinary words in German, whether they're, you know, a verb or an adverb or an adjective or whatever. And then Freud turns it into this abstraction, Nachträglichkeit, which is, the nearest English translation of that would be afterwardsness. And at first that sounds rather odd, but actually it's a word that's been taken up a bit because it's got a staying power in English, I think. And it captures that forward, backward, mm-hmm. double temporal dimension, the peculiarity of the temporality of trauma, the deferred action just doesn't catch, really. And that's what's at play in the transference papers, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, how to understand that compulsion to repeat that is the transference, and what is it that's being repeated, and is it real? Sometimes Freud says it's unreal, and other times he then turns around 180 degrees and says, no, it's a form of reality, a psychical reality itself. And he replays the same argument over again with the paper on transference love. You know, he dramatizes this little drama in which he has to say to an importunate and smitten female patient, you know, this love isn't a real love. You know, it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to your past, etc. And the patient won't accept this. And then he turns around and he says the analyst has to understand it's an unreal love. And then he turns around 180 degrees. And says, no, all the extreme qualities of this transference love that he'd been pointing to as grounds for saying it's unreal are really grounds for saying it's real, uh-huh. because all love is like that, basically. And it's a wonderful to trace through in that text the way in which this 180 degree conceptual reversal takes place in Freud's argument. Which itself is a symptomatic expression of what's peculiar about that form of transference. And it's what, in my account, drives Freud's whole conceptual career, really. And it's what I try to trace in the book. Who could talk about all of Freud's work? But what I've chosen is to focus on three chapters on the seduction theory, mm-hmm. on the literary byproducts of that. We haven't talked about literature in this conversation, but at the key turning points of crisis and impasse and reformulation, 1897, 1919, Freud disappears into literature, mm-hmm. whether it's into Oedipus the King by Sophocles or Shakespeare's Hamlet in the 1890s, or fits into the German Gothic writer E.T.A. Hoffmann and his story, The Sandman, and the whole aesthetic of the uncanny, Das Unheimliche, in 1919, where the literature, his turning to literary texts as a sort of thought experiment in which he replays the rival with decentering, recentering movements that are gripping him. He plays them out in relation to these literary texts. So The Death Drive is the, he's writing Beyond the Pleasure Principle and the Essay on the Uncanny on two separate desks, as it were. One is the reverse of the other, or the other side of the other, if you like. So The Death Drive, again, is where trauma returns in slightly disguised. Well, it's open at the beginning.
The war trauma.
And then he suddenly makes this wholesale transference across from a repetition compulsion. Again, a series of 180 degrees conceptual reversals take place, and suddenly he's talking about the organic compulsion to repeat. This extraordinary non-idea, in a way. So what looks like and what is normally treated as the triumph of the biological in Freud's thought over the psychological. And this is the initial idea for this comes from Laplanche, and I try to follow it through and develop it. Is actually the reverse is what's happening. It appears to be biological, but it's actually a transference from the psychical concepts from the psychical sphere are just dumped into the field of what's called biology. Mm-hmm. And so he talks about an organic compulsion to repeat. Now, what would that be? You know, this is a psychological concept, the compulsion to repeat. What do you mean calling it organic? and again, with the life drive, he has this extraordinary, he goes through all these experiments that he considers, various biologists have made, as to whether death is there from the beginning, an intrinsic part of life, or whether it's acquired, and living beings in their primitive form were initially immortal, and he considers various experiments, and then he just kind of sweeps them aside and says, doesn't matter. there would have been a tendency to the death drive underneath, you know, latently, and he goes on to consider the life instinct, or he still uses the German word "trieb" to describe what he's talking about, and he draws on libido theory and just says, "Oh, these protozoa, these fundamental, you know, units of living matter, libidinally cathect each other to form more complex, you know, biological entities." And suddenly you've got, you know, a wholesale transfer across into what's supposed to be biological discourse of concepts taken from psychoanalytic theory of the libido. So what he's calling biology actually is just a transposed set of simplified psychoanalytic concepts.
I mean, it reminds me very much of the early hysterical patients who would have paralyses that didn't make neurological sense, right?
Yes, that's an interesting analogy to make, actually. What looks like it's biological or neurological, but actually is determined by the operation of unconscious ideas and unconscious memories being played out through the body. But a lot of people, you know, take very seriously this apparent triumph of the biological, though it's not Darwinian, of course. He draws on forms of biological theory that would have been, by the time in the 1920s, no one really believes them anymore, but they were dominant in the 19th century, you know. So particularly his favorite one, the biogenetic law, so-called, in which the development of the individual replicates the development of the species. Mm-hmm. You know, so ontogeny rather repeats phylogenesis, mm-hmm. where phylogenesis is the development of the species through various evolutionary stages, which are replicated ostensibly, so the claim was made, in the development of the fetus and in the later biological development of the organism, mm-hmm. etc. And Freud borrows that term as a way to sort of prop up his idea of an instinct that doesn't lead to development and life, but leads to absolute discharge of all energy and to entropy and inertia, mm-hmm. Which of course is not an instinct at all. Mm-hmm. He uses the word instinct, but what he's talking about is an anti-instinct. Mm-hmm. You know, it's mechanical. It's there in the 1895, you know, project for scientific analysis as this, you know, discharge to zero. It's the blindest, most mechanical notion you could find. And even there, he admits at the beginning of that 1895 text that he's come to this idea by thinking about the way feelings and emotions work in dreams, in the condensation displacement of the dream work, or in historical symptom formation. So even there, it is most apparently anatomical or mechanical in the 1895 text. He says, oh, well, I got this idea from thinking about dreams and hysterical symptoms. You know, and then back, you know, 20 years later or more in 1920, when he's as it were, wanting to talk about the biological, the terms are taken directly. It's a direct conceptual transfer at the price of a massive simplification, it has to be said, but a direct conceptual transfer from trauma theory and libidinal theory.
Why does he do that? What's gained by that type of operation, attributing to science?
Well, I think it's an attempt to ground something, to ground psychical processes and formations that he finds, almost traumatizing, puzzling, anomalous, disturbing. That's what he did, of course, with some of the more simplified accounts of the primal scene. He wants to trace it all back to a real event, to something material, physical, concretely locatable, as it were, as the explanation for, symptomologies and phenomena that are disturbing and puzzling. Mm-hmm. He wants to ground it all in biology. But then if you look at the text, the final recurrence of trauma, conceptuality, if you like, is in Moses and monotheism. And I just didn't have time and space to do a close reading of that text, though I pay some attention to it because the trauma theory has a wonderful last efflorescence, in Moses and monotheism. In some ways, you could say the most clearly set out, most thorough integration of neurosis theory and trauma theory takes place in a little, enclosed conceptual capsule, if you like, in the body of this weird and wonderful piece of wild psychoanalysis, which is Moses and monotheism, and his speculations about Jewish history and et cetera. And buried in it is this extraordinary recurrence of trauma theory. But, of course, in that text, there's no mention of the life and death drive. Mm. There's no mention of the vesicle. There's no mention of any of the concepts which he had grouped around the model of the commotion to repeat. Yeah. It's just as if the text had never been written. These two texts in which aversion, either at the level of history or at the level of biology, is a compulsion to repeat, is the central conceptual matrix of those two texts. And they're like two ships that pass in the night. The concepts of one are not alluded to in the other, Moses and monotheism draws on totem and taboo, but it completely ignores beyond the pleasure principle. The death drive isn't mentioned, I don't think, in the whole text. It's quite extraordinary.
It's interesting. He has to repress the ideas even as he transcends what he's leaving behind. He can't work it in or explain it or apologize for it or...
I mean, it's as if there are two. There are these, what I thought of as gravitational movements within the Freudian field that don't let go, that keep replicating themselves and making demands and just reappearing, forcing their way into Freud's thought. And it left me wonderstruck and puzzled, by the outcomes. I was left towards the end of my book just looking at Beyond the Pleasure Principle, looking at Moses and monotheism and thinking, how do I put these two together? compulsion to repeat and traumatic repetition is at the heart of both of them. And yet they completely dismantle or, undo the other. Each one undoes the other. It's an extraordinary place to end up at the end of that very rich and innovatory, career of Freud. It's extraordinary. It left me just bereft at the end. I really didn't know what to say when confronted with... with these two extraordinary texts, really.
Well, I guess it's a late text in terms of chronology, but we don't have to think of it necessarily as a linear time, like you've been saying.
And of course, traditional psychoanalysis is embarrassed by, as indeed Freud was sort of embarrassed by, what he was nevertheless compelled to write. But it is an extraordinary final, like Beethoven's late string quartets or late Shostakovich or something. It's extraordinary, evolution or, revolution and repetition at the same time at a theoretical level, which is also something obviously he's living out. He himself signals that very clearly at the beginning of Moses that, his whole account trapped in Vienna, initial false hopes of the Austrian Catholic Catholic Church will protect the Jews, and a realization they're not going to, you know, and here he is engaged in an extraordinary deconstructive of exercise in a kind of rewriting of Jewish history as this you know, isolated Jew under attack, you know, in Nazi-occupied Europe. I mean, it's an extraordinary sort of performance, really.
On a personal note, reading your book and also listening to the podcasts of your lectures has really spurred me to revisit, or, you know, sometimes read for the first time, some of the more obscure or not obscure Freud texts. It's just a very inspiring new way of reading it. It's really made everything sort of come alive for me again.
Well, I think it does for my students, because unlike the way Freud is taught in psychology departments in universities, or even in training institutes, and I suspect it varies a lot in training institutes, but it's through paraphrase and summary, conceptual summary. And I think you have to grasp Freud's thought in its movements, and that is, you know, from one paragraph to another. Sometimes there are conceptual somersaults from one paragraph to another. You have to, you know, you have to follow the text through, and watch how it works. Really, and when you do that, students are really energized, and of course they don't then feel, oh God, this is a course about Freud. Either we're trashing him because he's wrong, or he's God and he's on a pedestal, and of course whatever he said must be right. You know, it gives them a way to pay attention, a really faithful attention to Freud's thinking and writing, but watching him struggling with these, you know, opposing tendencies that have, you know, brought into being his very field of thought, as it were. And it's a way of getting out of that idealization or trashing, which seemed to dominate the you know, public discourses about Freud. I mean, I think Freud trashing and Freud hating. There's an extraordinary book called Killing Freud that I bought a copy of because I just couldn't not buy it. Killing Freud, and you buy something called Todd Dufresne, and you thought, you know, what kind of psychodrama is driving that?
Or worshipping Freud would be the other extreme, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So there's much less of that these days,
right.
I think, and even in training institutes, you know, Klein has taken over, or Lacan has taken over, as it were, as the god on the pedestal. Mrs. Klein teaches us, or Lacan Guy.
One day there'll be a book, Killing Lacan.
Maybe. He certainly didn't want that. He would say, whereas Lacan would say, je suis le maître. Laplanche would say, je ne suis pas maître. Je ne suis pas maître. He really deeply didn't want that. Partly because he'd been a student of Lacan's, of course, and wouldn't participate in the sort of anti-Lacanian trashing, but distanced himself very much from a lot of Lacanian theory and practice, particularly the short sessions. But also, he didn't want that kind of that psychodrama around him and his teachings at all. Whether he'll escape it is another question, of course.
Right, here we are being Laplanchians together for this hour. And on that note, I want to thank you for your time. I enjoyed this conversation a lot, and your book, I recommend it for everyone, Freud and the Scene of Trauma. We've been talking with John Fletcher, and signing off for New Books in Psychoanalysis.